Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, welcome to this episode of A Time for Justice. I would like to say assalamu alaikum, and my name is Sister Pamela Muhammad, and I am the host. I'm so excited for tonight's show, so I wanted to just come on in. We had the music, you know, but this show is so important, and we have a powerhouse panel. So I wanted to go ahead and get this show started. As we all know, A Time for Justice is a show that discusses legal and current events in a roundtable discussion of legal minds. We discuss this country's centuries-long failure to apply, uphold, and enforce the laws, and the overall failure of the legal system to give justice, and the negative impacts these failures have had on Black people and their Black families. Ultimately, we want fair dealing. We want justice under the law, but all too often, this is not the actions that we see. So our guest tonight will not make those excuses for racist conduct often seen, which is really a distraction from the truth. And we know that the truth is the path to justice and equal protection. So let's talk about justice, fair and equitable solutions which are in the best interest of the people. Let's remove the distractions. So, again, my name is Sister Pamela Muhammad. I'm an attorney, and this is A Time for Justice, which is on the Elevated Places Network. We are so excited tonight because we're actually going to talk about the legal system. We're going to talk about the law. And the name of our show tonight is Black Lawyers as High Achievers Balancing the Needs of the Community. And, you know, I really thought this topic was so important. First of all, I wanted to lift up my spirits. I wanted to lift up our listeners' spirits by talking to some people who are highly motivated and who are spiritual people, and they just have so many good things about them, and the purpose is to inspire others tonight, because we want to talk to others who may be interested in coming into the profession and giving information on what it takes, what is needed. So again, this is a conversation about being and struggling to be a high achiever, because I think this is what these lawyers are going to talk to you about too, the struggle for balance. But we're also going to talk about balancing the needs of the Black community. And I wanted to call them public servants, because that's really what we are. We're servants, especially those of us who put God first, who put Allah first, and know that our mission is to help with the resurrection of our people. You know, so again, this conversation, I'm just looking forward to it. So let me go ahead and open up the mics and introduce our panelists. First, we have Brother Warren Muhammad. And Brother Warren is an attorney. He's a graduate of Texas Southern University's Thurgood Marshall School of Law. We have another Thurgood Marshall School of Law grad on tonight. So, you know, this is a collaborative effort, a networking effort. Brother Attorney Warren graduated in the class of 1979, and he has excelled in the practice of law. He lists personal injury, criminal defense, business, transactional, entertainment law. And again, our brother has been on the show with us several times, so I'm going to go ahead and open up his mic and let him greet you all. We're just so pleased and thankful that he's joining us. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Warren.
Yeah.
Brother Warren.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. I can hear you now. Yes, sir. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Let me first say greetings. Assalamu alaikum to everyone. And I got to inform you, something came up at the last minute. And I think you were talking about community involvement. My community involvement just caught up with me. I was notified just a couple of hours ago that there was a high school athletic banquet that I've been invited to in chapter 10. And I'm here now. I'm gonna be in and out. I'm gonna step out of the banquet when I can to try to still participate. But if I would just like to say that part of what I do is, of course, I'm an attorney, but I also am very involved in the community as the chairman of the CEO of the Acres Home Chamber of Business and Economic Development, which is a chamber of commerce in a business development nonprofit. With that being said, I have to be, and I am, very much involved in day-to-day activities in the community with the schools, high schools, businesses, and it's something that I, after 42 and a half years of practice in law, it's really something that I really cherish and look forward to doing on a day-to-day basis, being involved in the giving back through the nonprofit, and delivering services and education and training back to the community. So that's kind of where I am. And
yes, sir.
As you probably can hear the background, it's a high school athletic banquet. But we're putting on a Juneteenth cultural arts festival at the location of our nonprofit. And I'm here to speak with some of the principals and people at the high school about their participation in the cultural arts festival. So it was something that I really had to make.
Yes, sir. And Brother Warren, before you leave, because we want you to come back, but we want to also let the audience know that Brother Warren was the recipient of the Matthew Plummer Senior Service Justice Award, and that was given to him this, I think, last weekend by the Houston Lawyers Association. So this was a recognition by peers. And so we really appreciate, Matthew Plummer Sr. was an attorney here in Houston. Is that correct?
That is correct. He was one of the founders. Hold on one quick second.
While Brother Warren is doing that, then let me go ahead and bring on a couple of these other attorneys because, again, we have a powerhouse panel tonight, no shortage of talent. I want to go ahead and bring on Sister Nichelle, Judge Nichelle, who is an attorney. I mean, she's Nichelle Muhammad as the attorney, and she is also a judge, Judge Nichelle Johnson. She's actually at the Mount Vernon City Court in Mount Vernon. Sister Nichelle, born in Harlem, to a black father and a Puerto Rican mother. She talks about her family moving to Harlem from the Bronx and how she spent most of her childhood years, I think, in the Bronx. Sister Nichelle actually went to a college in Long Island University in Greenville, Long Island, where she graduated with a degree in business management. And so, Sister Nichelle, as we're talking about achievements and achievers and actually that balancing the needs of the community, she talks about how she became a math tutor for educationally and economically disadvantaged students, and that's where she began to see the right. Yes, sir, Brother Warren. Wanted to move on, so come back, join us when you can, okay?
Okay, great. I had to talk with the high school principal, so I had to get off the phone. But I'll come back on. in a few minutes.
Okay. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Keep up the good work. Thank you. And so, as I was saying about Sister Nichelle's recognition of how important it was to serve others at that point, so she went from there. She went to law school. I think she worked at the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. Then she went to law school. As an attorney, she began her career in litigation defense as corporate counsel for the city of Mount Vernon. Sister Nichelle talks about a litigation aptitude. She talks about how she helped to bring cases in-house. Sister Nichelle talks about how she won decisions in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. And now she was appointed the judge of the city of Mount Vernon in 2016, and she is in that position, I believe, today. I know she is a city judge, and she's going to tell us more about that. Sister Nichelle is married, and she has children, and she is a mother and has a wonderful, wonderful family. And for many of us, that is our greatest achievement. So I wanted to go ahead and open up Sister Nichelle's mic. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Nichelle.
Wa alaikum salam, Sister Attorney Pamela. How are you, sis?
I am fine, fine, fine. Thanking Allah for his blessings. Yes, ma'am. How about yourself?
I'm telling you, all praise is due to Allah. Sister Pamela, by Allah's grace and mercy, I'm doing well. I want to thank Allah for allowing me to be on this program tonight, and I pray that Allah guides my words and the inspiration I give to your listeners, sister. I'm very happy to be alive today and doing what I do. I am a sitting judge at this point. I don't practice law anymore, but I got plenty of stories of my 26 years of being an attorney and how I do what I do now as a judge. So I'm happy to be here. All praise is due to Allah. Thank you for having me, Sister Pamela.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. All praise is due to Allah. Thank you for joining us. And so next I want to open up the mic for another attorney, very dynamic veteran litigator with 20 years of experience. And I'm going to have to stop there because we're way over 20 years now. I know with this particular what he gave me, but Gerald Christmas is a veteran litigator focusing on criminal defense, personal injury, civil rights litigation. Brother Christmas has a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, having served as a parole officer, a municipal prosecutor, St. Louis City prosecutor. He's actually worked in all areas of the prosecutor's office. Brother Christmas is an astute politician, and he ran for prosecuting attorney. He's worked on a number of state and local campaigns. He actually helped Claire McCaskill get elected to the United States Senate, and he actually worked as legislative counsel in D.C. for 3 years. Brother Christmas has deep ties to the St. Louis community and really has become a national figure. Brother Christmas working on local radio, he's, you know, just a very involved person in these bar association, rites of passages. He's a Phi Beta Sigma, 100 Black Men, and he is another male man with a wife, four daughters. He's a family man. And so I wanted to go ahead and open up the mic for my brother, Attorney Gerald Christmas. Brother Gerald Christmas.
Hey, Sister Pam. Assalamu alaikum. Hello to everybody listening tonight.
Yes, sir. Wa alaikum salam. Yes, sir. So, you know, we're talking.
Thank you for having me.
You, yeah, I thank you so, so much for coming on the show tonight to join us. I think, you know, the spirit is high because we do have two very dynamic lawyers who are very high energy, very hard workers, who can share a lot with us. So y'all got me hyped up. And Gerald, Mr. Christmas, I'm laughing because you've been working all day. Brother Warren.
I have. I'm still working.
He snuck out this evening. Sister Michelle let me know that she, you know, sometimes she does some other things in the evening. She's open today. So, you know, again, we're talking about high achieving, but balancing the needs of the community. And so I kind of wanted to open it up by talking about a quote from the minister. The minister in last week's final call, I believe, he in an article called The Fall of America by the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. And we certainly know that these days we're living in, there's always so much going on, so many, you know, we got shootings, we've got disease, famine, all kinds of things, and these things are impacting our practices and impacting our people. Last week we had a show about anger management, and there was a brother who's a municipal court judge, and he explained to the listeners how these anger management classes are annexed to a lot of the, you know, the charges that people are coming in with, and how important, you know, this critical thinking and solving problems is. But let me just focus real quick. The minister says, and this is the part where we're talking about balancing the needs of the community. The minister talks about, if we examine the progress that we believe we have made, if it is the progress of a certain class of our people and not the progress of the mass of our people, then it's progress given to a few, that they may deceive the many into believing that this is a system that works. And, you know, so I kind of wanted to leave it there because I think one of the common denominators with the lawyers on this panel is that you all are always working overtime to look at the condition of the masses, and it's a very important balance that always has to be achieved because sometimes people, my daughter, she did a report on lawyers, and you know, this thought about lawyers being parasites. And lawyers, yeah, they achieve, but they just looking at money all the time, or they, you know, are unreachable, or they're, you know, totally talking about not the needs of the masses of black people. And you all are lawyers that I know balance the needs of the community while achieving, being high achievers, because that's an achievement in and of itself. So, I just kind of wanted to start off by talking about the interests and achievements that you all might primarily find yourselves drawn to. And I got a list, you know, activism, lawsuits, judicial achievements. Of course, that's you, Sister Nichelle, Brother Warren, importance of entrepreneurship and business, litigation success, volunteerism, pro bono faith. So does anybody want to just kind of jump in on that topic? Which ones of those topics are of interest to you? And let's talk about some of this.
I can jump in because when you say activism, I think that's where my heart lies, because I always feel like I'm an activist attorney, and I'm always, you know, ready to address issues. We just had the Annie Malone parade here in St. Louis, the May Day parade, and it's always a big occasion, and we haven't had it in 2 years now. This is the first opportunity to have it, and I went to my trunk, and I didn't have my bullhorn. I left my bullhorn at home, and I never leave home without my bullhorn, which tells you how much of an activist I am, because you never know when something is going on. And you need your bullhorn so you can be out there, out front, motivating our people and getting them engaged on these issues. So I find activism to be my go-to, my home as far as the legal profession is concerned. You know, I love being an activist.
Yeah. And I meant to give some updates on some of your latest works. Because, again, activism is sometimes lawsuits. It's also speaking out, like you said, against the injustice. So I wanted everyone to know that Brother Gerald appeared in the Washington Post recently, the last, I think it was within the last month, in an article on no-knock warrants regarding a lawsuit that he filed, you know, and he also has, you know, been known, and we'd like for you to talk about the fighting against the injustice when black leaders have been wrongfully attacked. I know that's an issue with Kim Gardner, who is the city prosecutor in the city of St. Louis, that, you know, you all have been active on. So those are some things that we want to come back and talk about. Let me go ahead and ask Sister Nichelle about her interest in terms of these areas. So, you know, I know with the judicial achievement, that's an issue, and the discernment and the compassion that you bring to the bench. Can you talk to us about that? Yes, ma'am.
Absolutely. So, you know, just as our brother indicated, depends on what your philosophy is. You have judges that simply apply the law that they're to follow, and other judges who are activist judges that challenge whether or not there are certain wrinkles through which they can get in between to basically be an activist to sway the court in the way they would like it. And I think as a judge, I want to say that I'm an activist judge to a certain extent, because I truly use this position to make sure that everyone that comes into my courtroom is treated equally and fair, and that while the laws say what they say, sometimes there's a gray area. And when there's a gray area, I have no problem slipping in as the judge and applying it as equally and as fairly as I can. There are some things as judges that we are privy to that maybe others may not be. For instance, when I was on the bench early on in my career, I would see traffic violations that were issued. And so there is a traffic violation for driving a vehicle on the highway when it's overweight and the like. And in addition to that, they charge what we call an 1110A, which is a 2-point violation that goes along with this other violation. Well, being a judge, I recognize that the police officers did not give certain people both tickets. They only gave them the one, which was driving the vehicle where it shouldn't be, but not the infraction that had the points. And as the judge, I could see the difference between who they were giving the two tickets to and who they only gave one ticket to. So part of my activism as a judge on the bench, I decided to be fair to all parties, when and if a black person or a Latino person came in with two tickets where I know others were only given the one, I wouldn't charge them with the other ticket. The other ticket will be covered with the other ticket, just the one. And so there are certain things that as judges that we become privy to when we can see the unfairness of how people have gotten to the court that we can actually fix while we're there. And so being that type of judge that makes sure that people are being treated fairly and impartially, even if they don't even know. I mean, some of the people say, oh, you're going to cover both tickets? I said, I am covering both tickets, but just one. And I have my reasons for doing it. But they say, well, I don't know what it is, but thank you, Judge. I don't make a statement about it, but I know why I'm doing it, and I understand why I'm doing it. So as the seat as the judge, we are uniquely positioned to do something that attorneys can't. Attorneys can argue and put forth their arguments and litigate and do a fine job. But if you have judges that are unjust, unrighteous, who are interested in certain decisions and ruling in a way that's not fair and just, then the system stops at the attorneys, which was one of the motivating factors on why I became a judge. Certainly, I made more money as an attorney than I do as a judge. But I understood that in the grand scheme of things that Allah needed me there to do something that only a judge can do. Lawyers can bring it there, but they can't follow it through if the judge is not just. And so that's how I've used my position to a certain extent to equal the playing field. All praise is due to Allah.
Yes, ma'am. All praise is due to Allah. Because as you talked about certain people, and Brother Christmas brought up a person by the name of Annie Malone, and, you know, talking about he have a bullhorn, you know, in his Trump. I think it's because of the needs part that we're talking about, the needs of the community. So I just kind of wanted to drop this out here. According to the American Bar Association, 88% of all lawyers are white and only 4.8% are black. So they talk about how there's a ratio of, for every 60,000 black lawyers, there are 686 black citizens who need assistance, compared with only 282 white citizens for each of the, I think it's like, what is this, almost, it's a big number, it's over a million white lawyers that they're saying. And so then, and they talk about that disparity even becoming greater because African Americans or black people are disproportionately entangled in the system. So, you know, one in, you know, just we know the numbers. We know the numbers. So this points out a greater need for us as black attorneys, you as a black judge and Brother Christmas at the Annie Malone home. And tell us about Annie Malone just briefly. Who was that? Who was that attorney Christmas? Because we're talking about high achievers.
Yeah, Annie Malone, she was a resident of St. Louis. She was a entrepreneur. She was also in the hair care business, and she was a major charitable donor here in St. Louis. And she started this home for children here in St. Louis over 100 years ago. And we honor her every year with what's commonly known as the May Day Parade. But it's in, you know, it's a major fundraiser for the Annie Malone home.
Right.
And
right.
She is probably, when you say early black woman millionaires in this country, she has to be, I don't think she was necessarily the first, but she had to be in like, the top five in the country. So she really made an impact with her life and impact in this region.
Right, right. Yeah, just wanted to put that out there. I think in the Madam C.J. Mm-hmm. Walker movie, she was the person perhaps that was depicted as the other black woman.
She was depicted in the movie, right, but
yeah.
they didn't have quite the rivalry that
right,
was depicted
right.
in the yeah. movie. They really did have a friendship and worked together.
Right.
But
right,
I think that
right.
was kind of spiced up for television.
Right, and to drive dissension with black people. And that's, again, why we as black lawyers and black professionals and people on Watchmen on the Wall, we have to make sure that our true stories get out. But we want to put out some of these stories of achievement tonight. And again, it could be black doctors, it could be black sewage workers, it could be black entrepreneurs building your own skills, black students. But we want to talk about achievement. So let's talk about the discuss. You know, the
and if
the
I could say one other thing, Sister Pam.
Go right ahead.
I just wanted to say one other thing. I wanted to commend the judge for being an activist judge because that is extremely important because judges are in a unique position and they really can make a significant difference. And we definitely need more black judges, more, you know, black men, black women on the bench because that makes a big difference in how cases can be resolved both on the civil side and on the criminal side. Judges matter, and having us in those positions matters. It matters a lot, and I appreciate that.
Thank God. All praise is due to Allah, brother. Yes, sir.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I think
you know, I have a mug in my, right quick, I have a mug in my office that says, a good lawyer knows the law. A great lawyer knows the truth.
Come on now. That's right.
Yeah. And so
that's
again,
right.
we're saying with these numbers, you know, with these numbers that our community is sometimes not exposed to because we're in this system of white supremacy. It's important. So I that Sister Nichelle has that discernment and has that representation from that community. And so going right into the question then of when did you first determine you wanted to be a lawyer? Let's talk about some of those early influences. And Sister Nichelle, I'm going to ask you that
yes,
question.
Ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am. Well, you know, it's interesting. From the time I was a little girl, I always said I was going to be a lawyer or an actress. And in a small way, I achieved both, because when I was an attorney, I was a litigating attorney, and I tried cases. I mean, it's what Allah blessed me to do well at. And so in a small way, when I had my trials, I was an actress, right? Because as a litigating attorney, you have to have the ability to use voice inflections to know how to gauge the jury and what they might want to hear, and using your voice and using your skill set to use words and use body language even to essentially put on a show to win your case. And so for the years that I spent as an attorney, I tried cases and I was successful by the grace of God, partially because Allah blessed me with that ability to have an impact on people through words and voice and the way I looked and how I presented myself. So from a small little girl, I always thought that was what I wanted to do. I then went to college, got a business degree, started working at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And then I decided, you know what, maybe one day I don't want to work for somebody. The spirit that we have to be entrepreneurs and have something for ourselves in case somebody doesn't want to give us something was a motivating factor in me going to law school part-time, because I had to work and I had no one to pay for school and I had a decent little career. So I went to law school part-time because at the end of the day, I said to myself, if I desired not to work for someone, as our brother on the line, I could have my own firm, hang my shingle out and start practicing law on my own without reporting to anybody, having my own something. And so that motivated me to get into the law field. Plus, I would, you know, it's a service field and you serve people and it's something that, you know, I think I was born to do. And so that motivation is what got me into law school, and the rest is history.
Beautiful, beautiful. And so I'm hearing you talk about the discipline, the compassion, the motivation, you know, very important. Desire feeds the wheel, as we're taught by the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. So this, you make it sound easy, but, you know, perhaps was it that easy? But I'll let you come back, because we want to encourage others and give them information on what it took and what you went through to come into the profession. So go ahead, Mr. Christmas, can you talk to us about, you know, when did you first determine to become a lawyer and why?
You know, I was thinking about that when you said it. I'm not quite sure if I made up my mind to be a lawyer or if my father made up my mind to be a lawyer, because he planted it in my head so young that I don't even know when I think about it if it was even my thought or his thought. But it became my thought because he planted it in my head so early on that I guess I just believed it was I thought that I always wanted to be a lawyer. And so, and for a while it's interesting because I did want to be an actor too. After I finished undergrad, I was living in Atlanta and I had gotten some headshots done and I was trying to make up my mind, will I go to LA and try this acting thing or will I go to law school? And I was thinking, I'm gonna go to law school first because I had that to fall back on if the acting doesn't work out. And I was working in Atlanta. I was a parole officer in Atlanta because I had done my undergraduate at Central Missouri State in criminal justice. And I knew I didn't want to stay a parole officer, and I knew I always wanted to go to law school. And so I made up my mind that I wanted to go to law school, and I took the LSAT and only applied to HBCU law schools because I had been in a predominantly white undergrad and I had already made up my mind that I wanted to have that HBCU experience. And I remember calling you, Sister Pam, and asking about Texas Southern because I knew you were in Houston. And
wow.
You said that Texas Southern was cool. You were down here. You had already graduated from Southern, and you were practicing. And they offered me in-state tuition, and that was all it took. I was on my way.
Yeah.
I think, you know, really what you have to learn to do, and as you get older, you learn more to just walk in your purpose. If you just walk in your purpose, everything else will fall in place.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I think, too, going back to this question, when we look at the early influences that may have shaped and molded, like Brother Warren, he mentioned on his when he accepted his speech, accepted his award, he said his mother always told him that he was just as good as anybody else. You know, and I think all of us, I mean, we look at we black people, we come out of the struggle of our ancestors coming up out of slavery and struggling to against this savage system. So was there anything that, you know, influenced you all to want to become a lawyer, to make those changes based upon any of that experience, as children or what you saw that was unjust for black people?
Well, outside, yes. You know, since I was born in Harlem, Lincoln Projects, and raised in the South Bronx. And as a child growing up, there was a lot that I saw and I experienced. I had a father who fought in the Vietnam War, came back after war to terrible circumstances. He suffered so much damage mentally being involved in that war. He came back. He was rather abusive to the family, and not because he wanted to, but because the circumstances dictated that he couldn't control his drug use or the fact that he had suffered so much as a result of the war. And so I grew up experiencing that type of trauma, if you will, and knowing that, you know, war was not for everybody, seeing drug use around me and mental and physical abuse, I think made me an advocate for people as much as I needed people to advocate for me. But Allah was very merciful to me, even in those young days, sparing my life, putting people in my life to help me get through school and, you know, being intellectually gifted programs and the like, and just understanding that we didn't have the best situation, but that, you know, people should strive to be a part of the solution to help other people. And so I grew up that way. And so service to people and things was very important to me. And legal work and becoming an attorney is a service field where you're serving people. I had the benefit of training under a black lawyer when I first left the Federal Reserve Bank to start practicing law. And he was a wonderful attorney who I learned from. And he told me, he said, you are a lawyer 24 hours a day. As long as you're servicing people, you're always with your profession. You go on vacation, you still got to take that phone call from that client that needs help or needs counsel. You, wherever you are, 24 hours a day, you're an attorney. And so I learned the work ethic, what goes along with being an attorney, but a black attorney serving people. It's a service field. You have to serve people. And it was something that I wanted to do because of my circumstances growing up, what I saw, what I experienced. And so it was a natural industry for me to go into. I embraced the advocacy when I was an attorney representing people. I was one of those attorneys that will leave not a stone unturned. Whether they were paying me or not was another thing that I learned from this attorney. Said it's not about the money. Whether they pay you or not, you're going to serve and do the best you can. Whether they were my friend, my cousin, family, I gave every client 150%. And so I learned that. It's a lot of work, but when you are born for this, serving people, you do it naturally in this field of law. Because giving counsel, giving reassurance, making people feel comfortable. I was one of those attorneys, and I still am, to to a certain extent where anyone could pick up the phone call and just call me and say, listen, I need to bounce this off you. This is what's happening. My cousin's going through this. What do we do? And I love nothing better than to give that counsel, even if it's not for money, because I'm clear about why God put it in me to become a successful attorney, to become a judge. And sometimes, and most of the time, is when people have to make that phone call and they can't afford to pay $10,000 for it or $5,000, or when someone needed an attorney. Part of the reason why I took the judgeship is at a certain point, you know, you could do so much free work, but because my spirit was service, I can't tell you how much pro bono stuff that I did as an attorney. But all praise is due to Allah, you know, for the spirit. Yes, ma'am.
No, beautiful, beautiful. Attorney Christmas, did you want to add any? Do you have a story, any influence in your background that put that fighting spirit in you?
I would concur with that 100%. I would concur with that 100%. You know, I grew up in St. Louis, but both my parents are from Alabama. And the reason why we ended up in St. Louis is because we got ran out of Alabama. I was an arm baby. My father was one of the first three black police officers hired in Huntsville, Alabama, but with a mandate that they could only arrest black people. And this was 1963.
Wow.
And, of course, my father being the advocate he was going to arrest anybody that was breaking the law. And he arrested some white folks. He was also questioning the mayor about the treatment of the black officers, and it caused a big uproar in Huntsville. And my mother said that they were throwing rocks and eggs at the house. She was sleeping on the floor with me. I was an arm baby. And my grandmother already lived in St. Louis, and in the middle of the night, they left Huntsville and came to St. Louis. And my father went to, you know, grad school. He became a social worker. My mother started teaching. They were always activist people, but they were also servants. People service,
right.
You know, by being a social worker and by being in the St. Louis public school system as a teacher. So we always had those experiences going back and forth to Alabama. I remember being in Huntsville when I was about 7 years old when the police were looking for Angela Davis. And my mother wore a big fro, and they thought that she was Angela Davis. And you know, we had one state trooper behind us, and next thing you know, we had 10, and they circled the car. And I remember, you know, I was sleep on the back seat. We had a Buick, deuce and a quarter, you know, and I remember waking up and seeing the police, you know, surrounding our car with the guns out, and my father getting out the car, and then telling him, you know, to pull his wallet out. And I always remember he said he told them to get his wallet out, because he had been an officer, and he said he knew if he'd have reached for his wallet, they'd have shot him. And so we had many experiences like that. My father was a baby at 10, and my aunts and uncles would always be talking about, you know, situations with white people in Alabama. And my great aunts, my grandmother's sisters on my mother's side would talk about their experiences. They all cleaned house for white people. You know, I came home one day and my children were watching The Help, and they asked, Daddy, you want to sit down and watch The Help? I said, I live The Help. I know The Help. You know, I remember being with my grandmother and having to stop at Mr. McElroy's house while she cleaned it up before we went fishing. You know, I know, and I experienced that. And when the judge talked about doing pro bono work. You know, my kids tease me now because they say I don't charge anybody. But, you know, people call all the time. She's right. They call you all the time, you know, 24/7. We'll be at the dinner table. We'll be on vacation. We'll be anywhere, and the phone will ring, and everybody will just roll their eyes in their head, you know, because they know that, you know, I'm going to take the call and it's going to be somebody calling. But I told them, you know, this is what I do. This is what I am. And so you just have to, as I said earlier, you know, if you walk in your purpose, everything else will fall in place.
Yes, beautiful, beautiful. And again, we're going to open up the phone lines. So if anyone has a question or a comment, you can press the number one to get in the host queue. But it's interesting because under doing good in the community, you know, we have historically and presently, we fight for the underdog. That's really our legacy, and it does impact our practice. And another thing, two things I want to bring up, two books. I was actually reading the Will Smith book, which I want to say I think is just a fabulous book because he talks about how he at one point said he wanted to be the best actor in the world. That became his goal as a little boy. He said he was too scared to even say it. But once he formed the thought, the mind, you know, it came out. Well, the rest is history. We know this brother's achievements, and he had some experiences growing up. Great family, but he had his ups and downs. Then another book, a book entitled A Lawyer's Life with Johnny Cochran, and that was kind of one of our focals with this show, talking about, you know, achievements, and that's our brother Johnny Cochran, because he's just a wonderful, wonderful ancestor that we had. And he talked about how he became motivated to change society for the better. He talks about how he played certain roles as an attorney that resulted in important changes for the community. You know, he talks about unpopular decisions that we as black people sometimes have, you know, because he was against the death penalty, but he had a brother actually who was murdered, and then he had to stand on that, even regardless. You know, so I thought those are some of the things interesting. He talked about fighting against black men being stereotyped, racial profiling, how especially this thing about using his platform because of how they come against successful black people. And this is something that we know him for. And so either of you all want to talk about things that you've done using your platform as a lawyer to change things for the better. Does anyone want to talk about that? And then we're going to take a call.
One of the things that I did was 20 years ago, almost 22 years ago now, I ran for prosecuting attorney because after I worked in the prosecutor's office, I realized how important the prosecutor's office is. Initially, I never wanted to be a prosecutor. I always thought, why would I be a prosecutor locking brothers up? But I realized that that was the power side of the criminal justice system. It was the prosecutor who decided who was going to be charged, what they were going to be charged with, and recommended the punishment. So the prosecutor's office, after working in it, I understood how critical it was that we are in charge of that office. And even though I was not successful in that run, I started to make people more aware of the necessity of having blacks in the prosecutor's office, the necessity to hire more black attorneys in the prosecutor's office. And today, in both major jurisdictions in the city of St. Louis and St. Louis County, we have our first black prosecutors. So we have come a long way, and it does make a difference. It's still the prosecutor's office, but it makes a difference to have blacks in that office and at the top in leadership that know and understand our community.
And if I could add real quick, Sister Michelle wanted to jump in. Last week, our show, we had a brother, Brother Maurice, who's a magistrate judge out of Alabama, and he talked about being in the warrant office, right? So both of you, Sister Michelle, Brother Gerald, y'all have, you know, been in the government work. But as he explained about how this is where people call, this is where people make complaints, this is where some discretion is used as to who's going to get a case against them or not. It was very interesting. But I would also like to say, because our show, A Time for Justice, we always talk about making our own communities decent and safe places to live. So along with, you know, that need for the government officials, we also see that need to have those type of problem solvers in the community who can and teaching and exposing our people to how we can better solve our own problems. So, you know, I had to throw it out there. Sister Michelle, and then we can take our our comments.
Yes, ma'am. All praise is due to Allah. I was thinking, you know, as a judge, you know, what have I done as, you know, since being on the bench? One of the things that I do, and I thank Allah for having been taught supreme wisdom, being a member of the Nation of Islam, is that I'm clear that when our people come into court in my city where I am a judge, it's mostly black people, you know, I show mercy and beneficence. And by doing that, you see your own people before your eyes really use their own self-accusing spirit to check when they know they've done bad behavior. And so because of who I am and what I represent, when people come in and they see me in the criminal part, that is, because I also do civil matters, the self-accusing spirit that they have when they see me there and I show them some mercy or beneficence, it helps them check some of the bad behavior. They feel terrible about it, and they want to be right. And they want to take the beneficence and mercy that they've been given and do something better with it. So I always have a relationship, if you will, with defendants. For instance, when they come in with their attorneys, I don't just say good morning to the attorney. I say good morning to the brother or sister standing there. Good morning, Ms. Jones. Good morning, Mr. Johnson. And that alone made people look like, whoa, she's saying good morning to me? It's like, yes, I am. And I treat them as human beings, but as they read the charges, sometimes I look at the brother or sister, look at them like, really? Come on, brother. Really? You know, and you should see the spirit. And then when I deal with them mercifully, and sometimes I say, you know what? I'm going to give you a little beneficence here. Do you know what that is? That's undeserved kindness, but I'm going to give it to you because I want you to see that you can, and I talk to them like that. Like how I've been taught, there are times when I'm able to say, you know, you need to, you know, overcome emotions and get into the thinking of God and stop being emotional. Now, you haven't been proven guilty of anything yet, but I'm just telling you. So I have used my judgeship to spread supreme wisdom that we use in a nation to help change a people. And they are our people, and they do have God in them. No matter what they've done, it's there. And if the right person is there judging them, you see them turn into better people right before your eyes. And so I'd like to think that I've been doing that since being a judge, since I've been there. And all praise is due to Allah. I've done well. I've only had about two people that did not return to court after I set them free. But other than that, I've been almost 98% then. With return
praise
to court and behavior checked. All praise is due to Allah.
Yes, ma'am. Beautiful, beautiful. Let's take this caller, and then we'll come right back. Any other callers who have a question or comment, please press 1 to get in the host queue. Okay.
Assalamu alaikum.
Yes, ma'am. Wa alaikum salam, Sister Brenda.
I am just beaming over here. This is so marvelous. I thank Allah
for
you and the attorneys who are so dignified and loving their people who come to your show. I think it's just awesome. And I marvel at Allah's handiwork, because this is the start. The kingdom of God is in hand. We are actually building it. And people like what I hear here, they are too awesome. Oh, my God.
Praise be to Allah. Praise
but
be
I,
to Allah.
My
thank
question
you,
is
sis.
Going to oh, you're more than welcome. My question is, I may be wrong, but I suspect that Sister Michelle, due to her Puerto Rican parentage, is bilingual, and perhaps Brother Christmas is as well. My question is, what insight can you share with us in regards to how you approach dealing with Hispanic or others who speak a different language in your cases? Thank you.
Thank you. Great question.
Wow. Brother Christmas, you want to handle that first?
Being in St. Louis, I'm not bilingual. And unfortunately, I don't get that much diversity in my practice. But when I do, because it happens from time to time, I deal with them with the same amount of love and respect that I do my brothers and sisters, because most of the time they're coming from the same vantage point as they are. It's just a language barrier, and it's just a need to educate them, because a lot of times they are not educated on how the system works and how they should be handling themselves as far as making statements to the police. You know, I always say, don't say anything, don't sign anything. I'm always encouraging people in our community not to talk to law enforcement without having an attorney present. And so I do the same thing no matter what community I'm in, and especially when I'm talking to young people, and especially in these schools, because the school-to-prison pipeline is real, and we really have to educate our young people in these schools, because you can make statements to the teacher and to the principal, and they will have law enforcement involved, and you will be on your way to juvenile before your parents are even notified.
That's right. Yes, ma'am. You know, sister, unfortunately, I wouldn't say that I was bilingual. I have a conversational and not great, but I'm good enough to break down some things. But the beauty of the court is, thank Allah, that there's always an interpreter there to do the interpretation. And it is very sensitive for me, because when my mother moved here from Puerto Rico when she was about 15 years old, she didn't complete high school, because at that time they used to just dump those Latinos back into the back of the classroom where there was a language barrier, and they really didn't learn anything. So she never graduated high school because of it. And so it's sensitive to me. But when I was growing up, we lived in the black neighborhood. So my mother really assimilated to that and didn't really speak the language in the house as much as she probably should have. So I learned some through relatives. You know, my grandmother spoke Spanish, but certainly not in my house, because my mother, we lived in the black neighborhood. So we were just, you know, the half Puerto Rican kids, children, excuse me. But, you know, we really didn't. But I learned conversational Spanish. I can break down some things. It is sensitive to me. So we make sure that our Latino brothers and sisters, and everybody else for that matter, we have interpreters that come in for all languages. But the Latinos are treated well, and I'm able to break down some things. Every now and again, the interpreter may not be on deck, and I'll be able to break down, you know, I need your name and address for the record, and break it down nice enough that they can understand. But I wouldn't say that I was bilingual by any stretch of the imagination, but I got a little conversation in there. So my mother's somewhere looking down saying, okay, you did good, you know. But yes, ma'am, it's a perfect question. But I deal with them in court. It's beautiful because those interpreters are there to make sure they understand everything that's going on.
Yes, ma'am. Beautiful, beautiful. And you know, I just want to say again that I'm really pushing the achievement part of this. As the sister said, we are so thankful on A Time for Justice that the lawyers come and spend time with us. All the people on this show, all the people who are listeners, many of the people in the nation, many of the people in the black community, you know, just to make it through the black community, I think I've heard, you know, our teachers, our wonderful ministers talk about, you know, that takes achievement. You know, so we're so thankful, though, that these attorneys take the time to talk about us. And it really, I just kind of wanted to throw it out here, how the Honorable Minister Sparkhan yesterday spoke on WBON, and it was such a enlightening and very inspiring experience. And I think that went into my desire to talk about achieving. And one of the things he talked about is how love, and he quoted the Honorable Elijah Muhammad about how we have to treat our brothers and sisters as ourselves. And this is so very important. So going back to Johnny Cochran, some of the things he talked about, and I think this is so important for you all as attorneys and judges, this whole discernment, you know, what we as black attorneys are bringing to the table to help with the needs. He talked about how in investigation, you know, it's so common, these lies that are told about how bruises came from scraping your face on the ground when really people are getting beat to a pulp. You know, how, you know, the critical thinking where victims describe a crime and, you know, black people, we'd be sitting there like, you know, this is not true. It doesn't even make sense. You know, some of like the, you know, the typical, well, you know, the black man did such and so, you know, and the built-in racial systemic racism that will make, you know, it more, oh, yeah, well, you know, if they say a black man did it, you know. And so these are things that you all as attorneys and judges in using the discernment, you know, can help people achieve. Does anybody have any comment? I know Brother Christmas with your no-knock warrant case, you know, people just get murdered because people are just busting in their homes, and then somehow that's supposed to be valid policing. You know, any of those thoughts that Brother Johnny, you know, so eloquently talked about how black lawyers bring to the table.
I think black lawyers bring that critical thinking to these issues, and we know our community. And because we know our community and we know our culture, we can immediately discern when something is just not adding up. And that's why you need to have black attorneys all throughout the system. You know, judges, prosecutors, public defenders, police, because we know and understand our community. I would prefer if we had all black police in our community. Sometimes the black police can be problematic, but they don't kill you. And we can work with them because they understand the community. These no-knock search warrants that happen, these stops that we have here in St. Louis they don't have any probable cause, that people are being pulled over and stopped and questioned simply because they are black. I've been subjected to that myself. Just because I'm a black man with dreads, you know, I've been stopped on several occasions. I know I've been profiled. They just did not know at the time I was a lawyer when it happened. But we bring that discernment. We know the questions to ask, and we know how to dig deep to get the answers. And then also when we are working with our people, I believe personally that, you know, we really have the trust of our people, and they really believe in the work that we're doing. And that's why I myself am so dedicated to it, because I know what it means to our people, and especially when you can come in and give them good advice and you can really help them in situations that are very dismal to them at the point, but you can show them that there is light at the end of the tunnel, and that, you know, we can get this issue resolved. And we're working with our young men. You know, so many of our young men need guidance that in this system. And sometimes, unfortunately, they won't really tune in and listen to you until they get in the system, but they will listen, and you can provide other opportunities for them. That's why it's good to have black judges who can say that maybe this person needs to be on probation. This person should go into a diversion program. Black prosecutors that can recommend maybe this shouldn't be a felony, it should be a misdemeanor. Or maybe this case should be dismissed altogether. Maybe they can just do community service. You know, it really makes a difference in the outcome of people's lives. I have a civil client that I just sent to the Job Corps program in Kentucky, and he was just texting me before we came on the show. He's only been there a week, and I had my fingers crossed. I was saying, I hope this program works out for him. I hope he likes it, because I really wanted him to get some different exposure and to get some career training. And so far, he's really loving it. And I'm just glad that, you know, I was able to make that happen and convince him that this is something that he should do.
Yeah, yeah, beautiful. No, that's really, and as you were talking about the treatment that black men get versus, and black women get by law enforcement versus white, you know, we have to take a moment on this show to just, you know, say a prayer and pay homage to those people who were murdered by this savage act of this, you know, white boy who took all the lives of our people, you know, mercilessly. And, you know, the families of these victims. And what really kind of stuck out at me is just to see the treatment that boy got, being arrested, you know, without what looks like a scratch. And, it, you know, we juxtaposed it looking at the young little boy who was dragged out of the store or whatever in the street because supposedly he had stolen some potato chips or some little juvenile. Have y'all seen that case? And we just know any of our young people, they're murdered, you know. Michael Brown, you know, just, you know, mercilessly killed in savagery. And so, you know, these are the types of issues that, you know, just deplorable in the black community. And so, again, you know, these people were somebody's loved one, you know, people who did not deserve to be murdered like this. And, you know, so I wanted to really, we had to at least talk about the savagery or at least reference the savagery. I believe there's a cover story on The Final Call this week regarding that story. And so we have to encourage the listeners to grab The Final Call newspaper, which has covered this story, you know, I'm sure, you know, a lot better than we could cover it tonight because I haven't been able to really look into it. But I did, as you were talking, Attorney Christmas, about the treatment of our young people and of ourselves, you know, because I can remember as a child being pulled over by the police in St. Louis, over there in Pine Lawn, and forced to get out the car and, you know, searched and behind, do I have on glasses or do I have on contact lenses? So, you know, this is the system that we as black attorneys come into, and we got to talk about the next thing. We're going to take this call from Sister Ula, but we got to also talk about the fact that one of the skill sets that lawyers do have is that we like to fight. And so we talk about some of those traits, because again, we want to encourage young people to go into the legal profession and talk to them about some of what they will see. So let me take this call from Sister Ula. She has a comment.
How you doing?
I am fine by Allah's grace. How about yourself, sister?
I am doing excellent by his mercy and permission. I called in to say that I really admire over the years the things that you've stated about the young people, about the children. And I was thinking, it hit me like a ton of bricks. Yes, ma'am. I was thinking we need to form a national coalition, just like we got the 9 ministries that we do every 3 months. We need to form a national coalition with a think tank to create ideas and suggestions for our young people and our children to eliminate the atrocities that they're experiencing. And I pray a lot that my suggestion will spread out to aid our children. Thank you so much. Assalamu alaikum.
Wow, alaikum salam. That's an excellent, excellent idea. And along with the fighting trait that I think, you know, lawyers, this is one of our traits, critical thinking, giving advice, you know, listening with discernment, focusing, crisis management, but fighting against injustice is one of the things. And I think debate class and defending ideas sometimes came early, you know, along with determination to finish goals. But one of the things,
right,
I think with what Sister Ula is saying as well is this issue about mentorship. you know, mentorship. And I know, Attorney Christmas, you've been really on the front line of mentorship programs. I know Brother Warren, he mentioned about how we as young lawyers, you know, we have had mentors to teach us how to become lawyers. You know, like Sister Ula says, some of the problems with our young is because they are underexposed. You know, they haven't had, you know, with integration, you know, everybody moved out. People maybe who could have taught, like I know with my dad, when we lived in the, you know, we grew up in the community. And so we were always going to be that people, those people on the corner house that maybe would take you to go grass cutting with us. You know, we were going to give that job if we could because we had a little company. And so these are the things, because people need skills, people need money, and especially today. So the mentorship piece, can we talk about that both in the profession of being a lawyer, helping young lawyers to know their way around the courthouse? I mean, Brother,
yes,
you talked about how you called me and I told you which way to go to the law school. So I thank a lot for that. Make me feel old. But what about that?
Yes,
anybody
ma'am.
Want to weigh in on
let me,
that?
Let me say this. Yes, ma'am. In the court, so a few things. What I do as a judge, I don't think I have one summer or one fall or anything where I don't have an intern working in my court with me. It's not a paid position, but it's an opportunity where our people can get an internship that maybe they never had access to before. So I'm the type of judge, anybody can call me up and say, listen, I have two students, whether they be high school, college, or law students, and I unequivocally accept them in. I've had as many as 8 or 9 at one time and didn't give a damn what nobody thought. I'd walk in and you'd see 9 children or young adults walking in right with me with their pads and pens going into the section to take notes and to learn from the internship that I provide for them. And so that's one thing I do on my give back, which again, it's high school. I've also entertained classrooms that would come in to watch or observe a proceeding, a trial. We do that as well. Now, within the court itself, with young people that find themselves in trouble, we used to have a youth court until Raise the Age went into effect in New York. And so a lot of those young people now go to the family court. But prior to that, anyone 18 and under would be a part of the youth court that I headed up. Once another judge had moved on, I then took over and became the judge of the adolescents part, and it was 18 and under. Since then, we've started a new court for those young adults from 18 to 25, because studies were shown that the brain is not fully formed in those young adults. And so while everybody was focusing on the young people under 18, they were missing out on the 18 to 25-year-olds that still had very real issues. So we have a court called the Emerging Adult Justice Part, where we take young adults in that age group, knowing that the young people now are being taken care of through the family court, because these youth now in New York cannot be charged as adults. They have to go straight to family court, where the family court deals with their issues. But we now are dealing with the 18 to 25-year-olds, what we do as a court, and it was a court that myself and another black judge started. And it's up and running as we speak. And we don't just do, you know, GED. We do a lot more than that. We give them the skill set to be self-sufficient if that's what they want. So we find out what they're interested in. If it's they want to be an electrician, we get them an electrical program where they study to do that. If they want their commercial license, we make sure we get them their commercial license so they can start doing that. So it is a program that's geared to actually trying to make them self-sufficient. And it has worked out so wonderfully because people are not forgetting about these 18 to 25-year-olds who are still struggling. And, of course, our babies 18 and under are being taken care of by the well-skilled family court judges who are now dealing with the youth that get into those criminal problems. So on every level, every step of the way, through my own independent actions of the internship that I give to anyone, basically, who requests it. I mean, you know, you just got to make the phone call, and judge is giving you that internship. to actual programs within the courthouse, we are really trying to do the best we can for our youth and our emerging adult justice brothers and sisters.
No, that's really important. Yeah, that's reform. You know, that is innovation, which is why many of us come to these tables, to be reformers, to be innovative. That 18 to 25-year-old age group. Attorney Christmas, are you still with us?
I'm with you. I was listening. I think that is outstanding because trying to help people to be self-sufficient is the road that we have to put our children on. And
that's
too
right.
many of our children are unable to be self-sufficient, or they don't have anybody guiding them to put them on the right career paths where they can be self-sufficient. And if they can be self-sufficient, the likelihood of them having criminal legal issues goes down tremendously, tremendously. And so I have an intern every summer. Also, as a matter of fact, my intern from last summer is just finished his first year at Texas Southern, at the law school. So I'm always encouraging young people to go into law because a lot of times they think they can't do it, that it's impossible. And I tell them, it's not rocket science. Anybody, read and comprehend, you can be a lawyer.
Come on.
You can. You can really
That's
be
right.
a lawyer. Anybody listening right now, if you
Come
can
on.
Read and comprehend, you can be a lawyer. It's just a matter
That's
of distancing
right.
yourself.
Right.
To do the work, but you can do it. It's not unattainable. It's not impossible. And the more that we reach out to young people and make ourselves available to them, where they can see and touch and hear our stories and know that we have had some of the same experiences that they have had, they understand, yes, I can do this. I can be a lawyer. It is possible. I want to be. I'm going to try to be. I'm going to do better. I want to be better. You know, you have to encourage young people, and they have to be able to touch you. You can't be housed in the clouds where they can't touch and feel and know who you are. You have to come down to earth so that they know that this is possible, that they can dream big and they can achieve these big dreams, and that you can finish law school. You know, you can finish law school, and you can be successful, and you can have a happy life.
No, that's beautiful. You know what? And I think that whole 18 to 25-year age range is so important because I know, Attorney Christmas, you've worked for years in the work of doing some criminal cases. And the prosecutor in St. Louis City, one of the problems that I think was not popular that she instituted was that she would not take certain cases, or she wouldn't take cases from certain police officers, I believe, who may have had a history
right.
of not dealing. Can you talk to us about that? Because, again, once these children get out of juvenile status, they become so much the target. I mean, they're targeted as juveniles, but by the time they're 18 to 25, this is a time when they get our children get lost in the system because there's such a
really
targeted
do.
Approach. Go, yes, sir. Go right ahead. I appreciate that.
Kim Gardner, who was a prosecutor in St. Louis, she came in with a reform attitude. Many cities have exclusionary lists for officers, but it was never publicized in the way that she did. She clearly said, and she stood up to the police union, because a lot of times what people don't often know is that that's your big problem in these cities is the police union and how political they are and how they're able to maneuver or elected officials and fight back on many issues, both at the local and state and national level. And she stood up to the police union and said that this was going to be her exclusionary list, and she was not going to accept cases from these officers because they were questionable. And she stood on that. The biggest issue with her was that our governor got caught up in a scandal probably less than 4 months after she took office. And some of the most powerful white attorneys were representing him, defense attorneys, and they came to her and said that if she brought charges against the governor, they would destroy her. But she did bring charges against the governor, and he ultimately ended up resigning. but they have been on a crusade to destroy her ever since. But the people recognized her courage and have always been behind her. And not only did she survive her first term, but her second term, she was reelected in a landslide. She got more votes than everybody running. And so the people are firmly behind her. And when the people know that you are speaking the truth and you're willing to stand on that, they will support you. And I'm very proud of the positions that she has taken, even though she's a prosecutor and I'm a defense attorney. You know, we do go back and forth on some issues, and, you know, we've gone back and forth on some things. But ultimately, she's doing her job, and she's also doing her job with care and concern for the community and especially for the Black community. And unfortunately, that age range has expanded.
What it's 18 to 25. Oh, really?
That 18 to 25 is really 18 to 35 now in my jurisdiction.
That could be,
It's that 18 to 35, you know, it's not just the 25, you know, because, yes, that 18 to 35, yeah. That 18
but,
to 35. Really, it's
but
really,
you know what?
And I hate to say it,
yes,
St. Louis,
yes,
is 14, it's 14 to, it's 14
yeah.
to 35.
Yeah. The targeting of our youth is real.
The
racial
target
profiling
is 14
is
to 35.
The
right, just
people.
Like you talked about, you talked about that monster in Boston, I mean in Buffalo.
Buffalo, right.
That killed those. That killed those 10 people. Michael Brown was 18 years old too, but he was superhuman. He was this monster, you
yes.
know, described as extraordinary strength, and you know, supposedly he strong armed, robbed somebody. You know, all of this fabrication about him,
right.
And then you have this monster coming to a grocery store and kill 10 innocent people armed with fatigue gear after he's driven 200 miles live streaming it, and already they're trying to say, well, he has some mental health problem and they treating him with gloves and he taking
right.
in, you know, and they just sitting there socializing with him after he then came in with army artillery and gunned down 10 people.
Yeah,
it's just the hypocrisy of
yeah.
how our children are viewed versus their children. And,
that's
you know,
right.
we have to stay organized and speak up about how this treatment is occurring and the hypocrisy of how they say one thing about a Black child versus a white child.
Yeah. No, and that's true, but it's, you know, like you said, it's the recognition that the racial hatred is there and that it exists. So the protection of our youth and this mentorship issue that we're talking about to expose them to positive alternatives and give them the skills and to avoid these systems, because as I'm listening to you talking about the expansion of the 18-to-25-year-old, it possibly is because once you're targeted by the system, this whole recidivism issue becomes an issue because, you know, you may get arrested, you may be thrown in the workhouse, and this is where your life begins to unravel because of that type of crushing, you know, treatment and debilitating self-confidence. And, you know, then you end up spiraling sometimes. And so the thought about prevention, we've talked about prevention, we've talked about getting people before they are going into these systems is so very important. And so that's where I think mentorship is such an issue. And we're down to the last 5 minutes, but I did just want to bring up the issue of unity. And I talked about you all coming on and sharing with us and the lawyers that do come on and share, and we share with each other. And so we've got formal bar associations that people may not recognize that term, but those are groups of attorneys who come together to share and network, you know. And I think as we grow, we're going to see how important is the unity and how important is it uniting with people who are fighters, who do have like minds, who do balance the needs of the people in the community as well, and not just look at the finance. Can anyone talk about that as we're closing this out?
Sister Pam, I think unity is everything, because without the unity, it's very difficult to get anything accomplished. So, you know, you got to have unity in the home, unity in the community, unity in the nation. We have to be unified as a people, because nobody's going to save us but us.
That's
nobody
right.
cares
right.
for us or loves us the way that we do but us. And there's always, through our entire history, there has not been a time where there has not been an effort to always keep us divided, because they know the power of our unity. And so
yes, sir.
Belonging to organizations and having that, you know, we have the Mound City Bar Association here, which is the Black Lawyers Association. We're celebrating our 100-year anniversary this year. You know, to be able to have, to come together as Black lawyers to talk about the issues that we have, to be able to address the issues that happen in this city as a unit, makes a big difference. And so unity is critical, because you need unity to have the power and the strength to really address the issues that we have in this country, and the force that they come at you with it, and the power that they come with it. You need that unity to be able to fight back. And
yes, sir.
I just honestly believe, you know, and that's, you know, unity amongst all of us, men and women. You know, we all have to be unified on the same page.
Beautiful. So I'm going to take this one last caller. But I wanted to say, I'm real fast, like the minister said, now we got to make sure that we got to examine the progress that we believe that we've made. And if it's progress of only a certain class, not progress of the masses of our people, then it's progress given to a few. And that's deceiving.
Right.
So let me take this one last caller.
And we have
caller.
To just quickly to say with that, Sister Pam, we also have to challenge in our own profession, because, you know, we will have people in our own profession, in our own race, that will feel like, you know, they have arrived and they don't really have to deal with us anymore.
Yes.
So we're going to take this caller, 312. I've opened up the mic. Do you have a question or a comment?
Assalamualaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Yes, ma'am. I just wanted to thank our brilliant attorneys and our judge, you know, Attorney
Christmas.
Dr. Ava Muhammad, the spokesperson. Sorry.
Come on now.
Doctor.
Great job.
But, you know, maybe we can do this another time. I'm so fascinated with the brain maturation part of this. And I've always been hurt that we are not working harder as a people to restore the Black family unit. We've been Americanized and Westernized in a way that we let go of our children too soon, and, you know, throw them out the nest, as it were. I remember Dr. Frances Cress Welsing once said she didn't think we should. That women should start, we should get married and have children closer to age 30 for females and 35 for brothers, because parenting is a sacrifice. And we have these young parents who are actually competing with their own children for attention and those needs that you think you have prior to 25, when you finally get involved in some risk management and executive decision making. But I love this subject of achievement and the subject of mentoring and starting to recreate that natural community circle that we had prior to slavery, and we need to get back that, and that will help us achieve that unity that everyone has acknowledged tonight is so crucial. But I just want to thank you all so much for your time and your wisdom.
Oh, thank you, Sister Dr. Ava Muhammad.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Your beautiful
words.
So on point.
Yeah.
So on point.
Well, thank you all attorneys for joining us with this topic. All praises are due to Allah. I just am so thankful for the time that you all have spent with us tonight and the time that you all have spent with us in the past. I would like to thank everyone for listening to The Elevated Places Presents a Time for Justice, and I would like to remind everyone to listen and tune in to Sister Dr. Ava Muhammad on Thursday nights with The Elevated Places, which comes on at 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. I would like to thank my producer, Sister Samaya Muhammad, for her wonderful work, and The Elevated Places team, that's Brother Terrence Muhammad, Sister Donna Muhammad, Sister Rona Muhammad, and you all can please go and listen to our archives. Again, I would like to thank Sister Ava Muhammad for her words and joining us. And Brother Attorney Gerald Christmas, thank you so much for taking the time to join us tonight. Sister Attorney and Judge, Sister Judge Nichelle, thank you, thank you, thank you for joining us. And thank you for all that you do. And tune in next week. Assalamu alaikum.
Thank God. Walaikum salam. Thank you for having us. Love you all.
Walaikum salam. Thank you.